Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey, great to be here.
Hi, Nancy. So tell people that don't know, what changes have been proposed for the SATs, and is it a good idea, bad idea? What do you think?
So let me first start off with giving credit to Todd Balf, B-A-L-F, the New York Times reporter who wrote this very long, very interesting, careful article about the story behind the overhaul of the SAT. The chief protagonist is a guy named David Coleman, who's been head of the College Board, the institution that administers the SAT, for several years, and decided when he took the position up, that he was in the kind of bullseye of a lot of different groups. Teachers were angry, parents were hangry. Parents both at both ends and in the middle of the income spectrum were angry. Students were anxious. Colleges weren't happy. No one was happy, and he went around and did a lot of kind of hunting and gathering and reconnaissance to try and figure out what was going on, how to overhaul it. So here, are the major changes. First, the SAT will go from being 2,400 possible points, right, 800 math, 800 verbal, 800 essay, to being 1,600 again with an optional essay. And but more important than the essay kind of peeling off and becoming, living in optional land, is what's going to happen to the content and the thrust of the questioning in both math and verbal. So Coleman thought it was very, very important, again, after lots of listening and research and thinking and whatnot, and talking to admissions deans, right, who, according to this article, people like William Fitzsimmons, who's been at Harvard for a long, long time, are encouraging of the changes, are encouraged by the changes they see. Coleman is going to make the content, the thrust of the questions, much more what he calls evidence-based. So instead of, hirsute is to bald, right, as birdhouse is to robin, right, or all those analogies, instead of that being a good example of testing your vocabulary, I remember the flashcards, right, in the big thick book of vocabulary words many, many years ago, instead of that being the kind of the kind of thing that students will come to expect, it'll be more like analyze this paragraph in the Gettysburg Address. Literally, they're going to use founding documents and then describe what Lincoln means by government of the people. So, and some of that will be multiple choice, but it will be much more based on our critical faculties, our high school students' critical faculties to take what they're learning in the classroom. Teachers were angry because they felt the SAT was based on all these clever kind of questions that didn't test what they were learning, and yet they were being held
judged for, right? Yeah.
Right, they were being held for accountable for in terms of school performance, and so it'll be much more based on like, well, I read A Tale of Two Cities, and here's what I think the word synthesis means when Dr. Manet talks about synthesis. So it's going to be much more about critical thinking and finding solutions within both the math part, which is going to be divided into three sections. I'll come back to that. Finding solutions based on what you're presented with, and very importantly, what you already know, because the one of the incentives of the reformed SAT is to make students very conscious that what they're doing in high school is actually going to help them on the SAT, as opposed to kind of bolting this on as a separate, very high stakes activity that is filled with anxiety for them. So it's going to be based on solving problems, both in the verbal part and in the math part, which will have some similar things. Can you figure out how to deal with equations, right? Because equations are very much part of, logical thinking in life as well as in school. Can you figure out how to use percentages and fractions and ratios, which we all have to do every day, even if we have a computer calculator and we do online banking, right? And can you figure out in what they call the passbook to higher math, can you figure out how to deal with advanced equations? And I'm not sure how that fits into the grand scheme yet. But again, the main kind of volte face, as they say in Italy, the main turning, right, of the ship of the SAT is to sync it up much more clearly and closely and obviously with what the students are learning in school, and to make it much more synced up with how predictable it will be as a guide to performance in college, and P.S., give people a chance to use what they've been learning all these years, which is how do you formulate an idea about something and then present the evidence. You have to do this every single day. You do it in studio all the time. Your guests do it. And then present the evidence to support what your creativity and intellect and emotional awareness has told you is true about a certain issue or person or problem.
Now, before, first of all, we should assure people that Volte Face will not be on the exam. Yeah. Now, you know, Emmett Price was here yesterday from Northeastern. He teaches there, professor there. And I said to him something that I want to temper a little bit. I said, I'm upset, actually, that the essay is disappearing. And frankly, if I had to dump something from the SAT, I'd dump the other two if I had to dump something rather than the essay. Because how you communicate, either orally or in writing, is critical. But then I remembered something that I had totally forgotten. One of the best shows Marjorie and I ever did was X number of years ago. And the reason I was reminded is because the opening paragraph of the story in the New York Times Magazine, that MIT had done a study. With hard data that shows that the content of what you say, the accuracy of what you say, the strength of your reasoning in the essay had nothing to do with the score you got. The only thing that tracked the score was the length of your essay. Now, and by the way, he had all this hard data. This guy's name is Les Perlman, director of writing at MIT. The best part of the story is, can I say his name, do you think?
Sure.
Matty Siegel, who's probably the most famous talk show host in town, calls Marjorie about a year later and says, and I hope I get this right, says, I was listening to your show that day. My kid was about to take the SAT. She hadn't done so well in the writing the first time. I told her, I just heard on the air that there's a story from MIT that Jim and Marjorie are talking about. Write forever. Doesn't matter how wrong you are. She got the highest score she had gotten on anything. So, while that is a real problem, would you not agree in a perfect world, I know it's not, how someone communicates their thinking in writing is more important than how they respond to a multiple choice question, even if it's more, as you say, evidence-based
much more important. So I teach this big course I've mentioned on the air a few times called The History of Leadership. It has a huge writing component to it, which is very unusual in business schools. It's an expository, critical writing component. Mm-hmm. My students write 5 short papers based on thesis statement, right? Advancement of thesis with supporting, cohesive, related evidence and a conclusion demonstrating the significance of what they thought about, say, Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, for example, which is mm-hmm. what I taught today. When I first pushed this forward to the dean of Harvard Business School, he was excited because he thinks that this is a critical skill for our MBAs. And yet, Jim, to your point, it's not really being taught so well or so diligently at all levels of the educational value chain before our students get to even postgraduate work.
One of my big problems is that they have stopped in even good school systems teaching kids how to write well.
How to write. And it's so critical. So I say to my business school students who look at me like I have two heads when I say the bulk of your grade is on these papers and then your big integrated mm-hmm. essay at the end that's going to be, 3,000 to 5,000 words. They look at me like I have two heads until you start pointing out things like, what's a great cover letter for a job? Well, it's a thesis statement about why you are a particularly good fit for that position and then the evidence of that. What's a great pitch for a new piece of business? It's a thesis statement about where the opportunity is and why you're the person who can deliver on that opportunity. What's a great business plan? What's a great sermon? Right? What's a great RFP? You name it. You have to use in verbal communication and in writing this faculty of critical thinking based on evidence that you have marshaled, selected, and then integrated. This is essential to effectively doing, creating a civil rights movement, if you think about Martin Luther King, right? Or Dietrich Bonhoeffer writing about anti-Semitism in 1933, or to founding a company like Amazon.
So if this is the case, you agree with me. Let me interrupt you. Just say,
please.
So this respected, and I've heard his name, never met him, the Fitzsimmons, is that his name?
William Fitzsimmons.
The sort of the dean of deans of admission, one of the highest profile of all of them. If people like him, who obviously know what he's doing, are celebrating the making the essay voluntary, and we seem to agree that that skill is a critical one, we're either missing something or they're – by the way, most people who have been critical of the College Board are celebrating the changes, not being critical of them.
But I think primarily because of what you just said, right, the story you just told and the evidence that MIT has, it's not – and it's even more egregious in some ways than you let on, Jim, in that, right, there's demonstrated evidence that people who actually wrote long essays with literally blatant factual inaccuracies still scored high. So I think probably – I don't know. I have no inside information – that over the next 4 years, this is the new SAT is scheduled to come into being in 2016. So mm-hmm. it's another year or two of the old format. I think we'll see once we see if the College Board can figure out logistically how to grade them. How to mark them and score them. Scoring them
That's a big deal.
It's a really big deal. How to score them, how to make the science of scoring, and therefore the message you send to students. One of Coleman's rationales is we're sending all the wrong messages to students. It's about memorization. It's about game playing. It's about spending, if you can afford it, lots and lots of money for the Kaplan course.
$4.5 billion for what this writer calls the worried wealthy. I love that expression.
Exactly, the worried wealthy. He's trying to send a signal down through the, you know, the educational populace, if you will, the students and teachers, et cetera, parents. This is not a good use of your time. Do your homework. Do your schoolwork. That's going to really help you for the SAT. And P.S., one of the interesting kickers in this article, I had no idea of this, is that he decided they wanted to figure out the College Board how to provide preparatory services that would reach all kinds of people of different zip codes and income classes. So guess what? They go see Mr. Khan at the Khan Academy.
Which is great.
And they've started a series of conversations and, you know, kind of petri dish templates, prototypes of how the Khan Academy might, with College Board, in conversation with the College Board, administer online free open access to effective test preparation. The Khan Academy is talking about doing this sooner for the current SAT as well to get at this inequality piece.
Well,
it's
the
terrible.
Interim.
It's so expensive. These courses are absolutely crazy. You know, you spoke about Emmett Price and Irene Monroe being here yesterday. We do a segment called All Revved Up, There Are Two Reverends. And Irene Monroe talked about the whole cultural problem here that, you know, she grew up in Brooklyn, you know, tough childhood. One of the vocabulary questions on her SATs, the word define regatta. And she said, I had no idea what were the multiple choices.
That's
is it
a great
card
example.
Game? Is it a both thing? So I would assume they're going to address some of that as well to make it less culturally biased.
I get this is the sense that this is a bottom-up renovation, right?
Yeah.
That we're starting with in the I-beams, right, or the concrete slab of the foundation in terms of emphasizing a totally different emphasis on content. I mean, I remember. I taught the Kaplan course, by the way, the prep course
you
for the SAT.
Not. Is that true?
I put myself through graduate school doing all kinds of odd jobs. I was a male woman. I taught the Kaplan course in Central Square many Saturdays. And, you know, it really is a test in how to prepare for a very particular kind of game or system. I'm not, you know, we understand why colleges have used this. We understand.
Even though they're using it less.
Even though they're using it less.
Which is one of the reasons why they're making changes.
You bet. And one of the ways they're making changes is because college admissions officers are not sure, and professors and faculty are not sure this is a good predictor, right? The ACT is interestingly, which is much more content based in the way we're talking about content,
much
and
more
knowledge based,
competing,
and it's
heavily.
Competing much more intently. It's getting used more often, I think, because of some of mm-hmm. these issues than the SAT. So they've got competition, as one of the commentators in the Washington Post said, it's Pepsi and Coke here, this is Coke's new salvo. But one of the reasons this is really important, and the reason they're doing it is because they're trying to get away from the idea that this is this very high stakes, very anxiety provoking. Enterprise has nothing to do with the rest of your life except that it determines or can have a huge role in determining the big gateway into upward mobility and economic possibility, which is college education. It's not the only road. It's not the only door, but it's an important door.
You know, you spoke about the equality issue a minute ago, as did Marjorie. And one of the great ideas, which is only an interim fix, for lack of a better expression. I mean, on the Khan Academy thing you talked about is heartening. Mitch Kapor, who is the founder of Lotus Software, who's a local guy. I think he used to live in Brookline or whatever. I don't know if he does there anymore. This piece in the New York Times mentions that he co-wrote an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle. I love this.
Yeah.
Suggesting that colleges require mandatory disclosure by students and parents of, quote, each and every form of purchased help as a way to level the playing field. Meaning, while you're working on leveling the playing field, both in terms of, as you say, the cultural bias, Marjorie, the questions themselves, and about the access to help and broadening that as well. Obviously, if you have Marjorie Egan gets 550 and Nancy Kane gets 600, you would say if all other things are equal, they take Nancy Kane if you have similar outside, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you find out Nancy Kane spent $4,000
exactly.
at the Kaplan course that another Nancy Kane taught, the likelihood is it puts Marjorie Egan back in play. And
yep.
so I think that disclosure thing is great.
What else is surprising? That the schools themselves, the public schools or private schools for that matter, maybe private schools do, I don't know, but the public schools don't offer free help. I mean, when I was in school, We got drilled every day for the SATs by our English teacher. I wish I could have got drilled more by the
math. I don't know if I took courses or just used books for the SATs. When I took to get into law school, I took the LSAT. Mm. The courses there, Marjorie, are full time. At like 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, for weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the SAT is not, though.
Well, but it's but let me tell you, when we were in school, it was not nearly as cutthroat as it is now.
No.
You've written articles about it. We've read articles. It is so cutthroat, the competition, particularly in the parental level, forget the kid level, that $4.5 billion
is the prep
spent
industry.
On this is just unbelievable.
I know Kaplan is going to be very upset if all of a sudden Khan Academy is offering his courses for free.
They are, and so is the Princeton Review. It's interesting if you look at some of the data, though, and this is – Coleman knows this better than anybody, right, that about how different test scores, right, just correlate directly with income, correlate directly with parental degree, right, educational achievement. They correlate with, you know, in some sense, privileged achieving households with means – being able to nurture their children and move them, you know, straight on up in a way that is simply not so possible for now increasingly the middle class and the working class. Interestingly, one of the things that Coleman and his team are trying to do at the College Board, they're modeling some of what they're doing off of what Daniel Portersfield has done at Franklin and Marshall, the president of that college in Pennsylvania, is to literally reach out into high schools, reach out into, in general, less privileged or middle class kids who have scored very, very well in either high school or in the SAT and encourage them to apply with lots of financial aid to selective colleges. So trying to pull people in. Franklin Marshall has pioneered. They have broken all kinds of paths doing this. And Portersfield will say, we're a more diverse, we're a more connected, we're a better educational community.
Well, so is your place as a result of the reviled Lawrence Summers, who started the income blind. I mean, he did, despite the other criticism.
Oh, yeah.
Saying if your family income was under, I think at the beginning, $40,000, and now it's – but, you know, one of the things that we started on yesterday, if you were to say to me, and I have no expertise in this area – is it the writing thing? Is it math and verb? What's the single most important thing they should do that they don't almost ever anymore is interviews. If you said to me, I'm the dean of admissions of a college, what's the one thing I want to do? Forget, you don't need an SAT.
Big schools can't afford it.
Don't even, you know, but you know what a lot of schools are doing? And one of my kids had this experience because I said
interviews.
You need alumni interviews.
Yeah, those are great.
You train alumni. It's not as good as having people who are experts in the field. Yep. But don't you get to know a person and their brains and their skills 1,000 times better when you sit across from them for 30 minutes than reading how they did on a multiple choice exam?
Yeah, a lot of small schools still do the interviews, but a lot of big schools do not.
I don't know. I should know this, but I don't know if Harvard – I don't think they require it at the college level. I know for many years that I've been there. I'm a Harvard alum at the graduate level, not at the college level. My graduate degrees are from Harvard. They encouraged interviews by alumni. So a good friend of mine, Tess O'Toole, is a PhD and a BA from Harvard College. She used to interview people all the time that were applying to Harvard College. That was clearly part of their folder. Whether that was required or not, I simply don't know. And I know that certainly lots of graduate schools, business schools, use it as a tool to get a sense of the person. You know, I was just coincidentally last night eating popcorn at 11 o'clock and reading the Stanford magazine. My AB is from Stanford.
And
Fred Hargadon.
And so is Marjorie Egan.
And Fred Hargadon, Marjorie knows that name. Fred Hargadon, who was the dean of admissions, who admitted Marjorie and me. many years ago, and then was later dean of Princeton's admissions, died recently. And he was known for remembering every single freshman's file. I remember he knew my file.
I love that.
He knew it. He knew what my SAT score was. He knew I'd play tennis, and he loved my essay wanting to be a pro tennis player. And he talked about just that. You're taking the whole person. Right, you're taking the whole person.
Well, I love it. And I wish, and you're right, the expense is the issue, so be creative about it and fix it.
Yeah, and it is just so, it's so unfair, as you said. If you're a middle-class kid, you can't afford all these extra tests, or you're really struggling, it's just so unfair. But anyway.
When I was applying, I was hoping they wouldn't do interviews, by the way, and luckily they didn't, so it all worked out pretty well.
Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business
School,
where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, great to see you, as always. And thanks to you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we've got Boston Editor Globe Boston Globe editor, Brian McGrory. He's going to be here. And we're going to have our concert roundtable, which is fantastic. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. And I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browley.
And we're so glad you're here, Jim.
See you
later. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.